Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Starting our show on a telephone, hopefully we'll switch over to our Comrex and you'll be able to get a little clearer sound. We have a lot to share. The latest on health and healing, some scientific reports that show that we're not paying attention, nor are we doing anything constructive in this moment for the environment. Also, a good report from a Dr. Cole about the latest study on vaccines showing that the flu vaccine is worthless. Well, then why promote it? Well, because it's profitable. Also, today we'll have some audio clips, and among those audio clips will be some that ask a basic question, and that is, why don't we hear more diverse ideas, even ones we disagree with, so that we can then come to some understanding of whether or not what we have embraced is all true all the time, or should we re-examine? And that's what I believe is how mature people come together. You don't attack each other. You don't name call. You don't use the media as it's done today to denigrate anyone or whole groups of people as the other, and therefore they lose their sacredness, so anything that's done against them seems to be okay. How have we fallen so far from a higher level of civilized conduct? So we're going to have people on who are controversial, who probably have never been on a Pacifica station, because we only allow people who are the most radical thinkers and not always constructive on. I believe that you have to have all people on, agree and disagree. That's fine. We're going to start doing that. I want to see different points of view that you can then deconstruct their arguments or support them in part or whole. Today, we're going to look at a couple issues. Among those issues are what's going on in our educational system, and how much more delusional can university students get? I'm very concerned. Now, this is something that's intimate to me because I've been a college instructor, professor for a long time, decades. And as a result, I've seen where people used to come as learners. They wanted to learn. They wanted to be challenged, and they wanted to be able to challenge. And they wanted to develop critical thinking skills. That's a healthy educational system. But when you come into a classroom and you tell the teacher, you don't want to be tested, you don't want to do midterms, you don't want to do papers, you don't want to do any homework, and you want to have the curriculum be taught to you so that there's special speech codes. And these speech codes are to exclude any words that you may find offensive or cause you some anxiety. You want the university to have a special room where you can go in and hug teddy bears or get counseling because somehow you feel overwhelmed and threatened. Wow. I thought we were supposed to look for excellence in everything and in everyone and be there to nurture them and encourage them and to support them. I wasn't aware that we were supposed to honor stigmatization of all things that we do not accept. I wasn't aware that this whole phobia of inclusion is a contradiction. And if you doubt me, I'll show you how much of a fraud it is on today's show. It's a complete, total fraud the way they are doing this today. Because if I am invited into a group and I'm a vegan, and they're meat eaters, I'm excluded. So how is including a vegan that's excluded, reprimanded, attacked, vilified, and then the people say we feel threatened by someone talking about what we're doing to animals? It makes us feel bad. Yeah, fool, you should feel bad, unless you are going out there and slaughtering the animal that's a sentient being and watching a cow cry and tears come down its cheek as it sees its death being imminent. Yeah, you're going to go kill the cow and eat it? Fine. If you're not, then if you feel threatened by someone else who's a vegan honoring life, God, how far we've fallen. It's a disgusting disgrace, our universities today, and the students who attend them who cannot accept what their responsibility is to be a learning. So I'm going to start playing a hell of a lot of stuff that's getting in the face of these people who have captured the entirety of our society, our media, the government, with their fascistic ideas. They want to control our speech. They don't want free speech. Pacifica doesn't want free speech. What a bunch of... I can't tell you how loathsome I think the people at KPFK are and other stations for censoring speech from people who are telling the truth to power, the thing it was created to do, and now they're not allowed to have a form like Bonnie Faulkner and others. I wouldn't support any of those damn stations if I were you. I don't think you have to worry about that. They're sinking into their own corrupt mindset. In any case, so they don't want free speech. Nobody wants free speech today. Why? Because free speech might also be honest speech. They want controlled speech, speech codes. So don't say anything that represents a truth that other people might find offensive. Wow, how far down the rabbit hole have we gone as a society? So we're going to talk about it. We're going to bring people on the air. Unlike other programs, we're not afraid to confront the important and essential issues that the left and the right have tried to have complete control over. If you need to listen to this program by a telephone, let me give you a number. Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, you can call this number from any phone or cell phone or a hard line or a computer, and you can listen in. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. But a lot of people, probably 98% of all people listening on the archives when they have that time to do it. Our archive number, we can listen up to 5 shows with just a call at 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Now, to the latest in good science, showing us the benefit of different ways of living, I've been told, "Would Gary, coffee is so good for you, why don't you advocate it?" Well, because you have to look at what part of coffee is good and what part is not. In point of fact, the coffee bean is very nutritious because it contains polyphenols, such as chlorogenic acid, that have demonstrated very important health benefits. And for those of you who don't want to have the coffee, because where you could take a capsule containing the chlorogenic acid from the polyphenols from the green coffee bean, that's good. But each morning, about 64% of all adults in America consume at least one cup of coffee. That's bad. Now, yes, they can show you a study how it will increase attention span, but that's an artificial inducement. Here's what they leave out. They leave out the fact that it can adversely affect the nutrients in your body because it's a diuretic, and it can wash out vitamins essential to your well-being, like zinc, magnesium, potassium. Also, the brain responds by releasing noradrenaline that quickly provides an energy boost. However, how long after you take that first cup of coffee do you feel that caffeine letdown, whereby noradrenaline in the brain is depleted and subsequent coffee fails to provide sufficient mental boost? So you take 2 cups or 3 cups or cappuccino or one of these high-level energy drinks, which are extremely dangerous, in my opinion. According to a recent poll, 26% of Americans say they're addicted to coffee. Have you seen how many of those same Americans end up with GERD or gastric reflux, where it is so anabolic, it is so acidic, that caffeine in the coffee hits your stomach and hits the hydrochloric acid in your stomach needed for digestion, and then you end up with acid indigestion. Well, many people have what is called brain fog that develops in the mid-afternoon. And that's generally where the body would normally not have any problem providing sustained glucose. But not when you've been taking caffeine, because you're exhausting your adrenal gland that gives you a natural adrenaline. So that's the problem. That's just the beginning of the problem. It can also lead to brittle bones and osteoporosis. It can lead to local inflammatory conditions like arthritis. And it can even harm people who have AFib or tachycardia or irregular heartbeats. So here's a positive solution. Cocoa, C-O-C-O-A, which is chocolate, and spearmint. That's correct. Why? Because cacao and spearmint is a great alternative for erasing brain fog and achieving mental clarity. It really does work. These are all natural compounds. They've been clinically proven to improve attention and concentration by preserving brain neurotransmitters such as noradrenaline. So when you have spearmint extract, and you can buy it in any health food store, and you combine that, just put some drops of it. If it's a liquid form, you can get a liquid form, into cacao powder and mix the two together like you would having a chocolate drink. That's terrific. That will give you a greater boost in mental sharpness and focus and attention. In addition, cacao is a microvascular blood flow dilator. That means that the circulatory system to your brain and to your extremities, like your legs and feet, is improved. And especially you want more oxygenation in the brain regions needed for focus and working memory. Now, spearmint leaves, you can buy that in almost any store. They've long been used in cuisine, because they're very soothing, and they create a refreshing scent, and that helps you relax. For example, you can actually get essential oil of spearmint and lavender, and if you put 2 drops of lavender oil and 2 drops of spearmint oil on your pillow, oh my goodness, it helps you go right to sleep, and that's good. Now, there's 2 recent scientific studies that I read that show that there are phenolic compounds found in it's easy to get spearmint and chocolate together. All right, and there are actually controlled studies on this showing in memory improvement and improved in working memory. So, and this was against placebo. So that's the latest on helping people get better night's sleep, having more mental acuity, sharpness, and getting away from that very toxic acidic causing coffee in the morning. Also, one last thing. Phenolics present in spearmint inhibit acetylcholinesterase. Now, that's an enzyme, and that enzyme results in a higher concentration of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, which is critical for memory and cognitive function. So it plays an important role in your brain. Now, another thing that's important is vascular health. And I believe you all would benefit from improving your vascular health. And the optimal heart-healthy program depends upon many factors, including proper functioning of your endothelium, T-H-E-L-I-U-M, endothelium. That's that thin layer of cells lining the interior of the entire circulatory system. And with all the heart disease we have, and with all the people who don't even know they have a heart problem because it's frequently silent, there's no symptoms until you have a stroke or until you have a heart attack. And especially for those who go out and work out in the morning and you haven't really hydrated properly, well, when you start to dehydrate and you're exercising, you're doing something that's not good for you. You're creating thickening of the blood. You don't want thick blood. You want thin blood. Well, water and watermelon juice and celery juice, and most importantly, lemon juice, help naturally thin the blood out, and it helps space the red blood cells from aggregating and causing a clump, especially where you might have a crimp in the arterial system. So what would be the top, let's say if I had to give you three things to really help your heart and your epithelium? Number one, I would give you pomegranate concentrate, or eat pomegranates every day, like a pint, or pomegranate capsules. That would be terrific because that provides potent polyphenols that are clinically shown to support healthy blood flow. And then I would give you a cordiart, C-O-R-D-I-A-R-T. Now, that's an extract from sweet orange peels, and that activates the endothelial production of nitric oxide, which then in turn supports healthy circulation. By the way, beet juice does the same thing, even a little more powerful. But this cordiart is terrific. Again, look for sweet orange peels and take that too. And then finally, I would offer something that you just never hear about. I haven't heard about it in years. Superoxide dismutase, or SOD. Dismutase is dis, D-I-S, mu, M-U, taste, T-A-C-E. And that supports healthy arterial function and boosts the body's protective enzymes. So when you're taking those three things, you are creating an endothelial system that is healthier. You're helping to make it more elastic, more pliable, less rigid. You're helping to remove some of the tissue that has been ruptured, some of the scabbing inside the arteries. So you're helping prevent a heart attack. And by the way, one thing that we should be taking is B1, 2, 6, 12, and 5 every day. You need a B complex, and you're just not getting enough from your diet. So when conventional B vitamins are ingested, they must be enzymatically converted in the body to metabolically active forms. So try it when you buy one. Buy an enzymatically active form of the B complex. This includes pyridoxal 5-phosphate. That's what the body uses as vitamin B6, the metabolically active form. Again, you can take vitamin B6 by itself, but it's not going to be converted easily. If you take the enzymatically a part that converts it into pyridoxal 5-phosphate, and it's just to show you that everything has to be converted into its biologically active form, you know, like all the B complex have to be converted, and then they're like 700% more bioavailable to the body. All right, simple things like that make a difference. Also, there's an extract of a Chinese herb that exhibits protective properties against cerebral diseases. Now, this is from Capital Medical University in China, and it was published in the British Medical Complementary Journal of Alternative Medicine, and it shows that, well, you would know it as foxglove, F-O-X-G-L-O-V-E, foxglove, one word. And it's a plant, and it's been used in Chinese medicine for a long time, and it shows great promise as a means of protecting the brain from cerebral diseases. So, and that includes multiple sclerosis, because in multiple sclerosis, you have defects in the myelin, M-Y-E-L-I-N, and it's specific. It's called MOG, which is a glycoprotein 35-55. And when that's defective, that causes you to develop all forms of autoimmune encephalomyopathy and other conditions. Well, this helps protect that. It protects your brain. So, good. So that helps you with brain. And also, there is a product. In fact, I just tried some last week. I found some at a market, and it's called Purple Mangosteen, Mango, M-A-N-G-O, Steen, S-T-E-E-N, Mangosteen. It's purple. It has a purple flesh, and it's delicious. You can find it all over Florida. You can grow it yourself. Well, according to the Maranthia Christian University in Indonesia, and also published in the British Medical Complementary Journal, it is good to treat malaria. So for those of you who are traveling to places around the world where you're susceptible to getting mosquito bites that could contain the malaria pathogen, always take some purple mangosteen concentrate with you. And that could help. Remember, we're heard all over the world, not just in urban and suburban areas. And so people listening right now may be able to benefit from that. And finally, this is from the Chinese Medical Academy, and it shows that 70% of Americans own grills that expose them to particles that have been linked to lung, skin, and bladder cancers. But there is a caveat. We know, this audience knows, that cooking foods, especially meats at high temperatures, can give them, well, that charcoal quality that some people like. But when you cook a steak, for example, you're generally cooking at 300 to 400 degrees on the grill. Well, as the meat cooks at those temperatures, the process can lead to the release of chemicals called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. These are very, very inflammatory. These compounds have been found to cause genetic mutations that can lead to cancer. And most notably, these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons have been linked to lung cancer, bladder cancer, and skin cancers. Now, meat is composed of muscle and fat tissue. And as these meats heat, amino acids and sugars and other components come together, and they drip on the hot coals below them. And they are converted to PAHs, which get carried back upwards into the food and on the grill and in the smoke. In fact, here's what most people never know. I'll bet you didn't know this. Just standing near a barbecue grill could raise your cancer risks. That's right. It's not just eating the steak. It's actually breathing the smoke from the grill. And then combine that with eating this stuff, and boy, you have absorbed carcinogens through the skin and through your gut. Both of those are bad. And by the way, one more study about meat eating, and that is Harvard School of Public Health had just finished an article about grilling beef and chicken and fish can also lead to, at high temperatures, lead to cancer-causing chemicals to form. So two separate studies on grilling show it's bad to the bone, and this study also showed a rise in high blood pressure. And that's dangerous. So this study included 32,925 nurses from the Nurses' Health Study, and 17,104 physicians from the Health Professional Follow-Up Study. And this grilling over a period of time causes. So, not good. So just be aware of that. We just don't want anyone getting sick. And that's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall on the road. And we're going to be taking a break. And when we come back from the break, I just thought you'd like to, if we have them, I'm in a different room, a quiet room, trying to, do the show. But we just had a group of people from our audience spend a week in silence, learning how to think deeply, think critically, and engage in healthy exercises, diet, cleansing, detoxification. And a couple had such remarkable effects, they wanted to stay one extra week, and we said, all right. And we're going to have, if I can get them on the phone, we're going to have them on the phone in a moment. But first, we're going to take a break. Please stay with us. We got a lot to cover. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Speaking on a phone, but we have an IT person here, Peter. And he is trying to get us up and working, and hopefully we'll get it. We're way out in the boondocks, and there was evidently a lightning strike, and so we have a lot of techie people, and they're all looking to get us back up. If we're not back up today, we certainly will be back up tomorrow, hopefully. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to play one clip, because I really think we need to hear what this person is saying. Again, you can agree or disagree with what this person says, and this person we're going to hear from in a moment is Professor Heather McDonald, about how much more delusional can university students get. And for those of us who teach in universities and have worked in universities, that's important. But we need to hear this and then decide whether any of it makes sense to us. Maybe it doesn't make any sense. Maybe you feel it's wrong, but at least let's hear what they have to say.
Here's conference topic, which I think is even more important than free speech. The assaults on free speech on college campuses, the attempts to silence nonconforming speech through administrative fiat, brute force, and sometimes actual violence is a clear betrayal of what the university should stand for and model for the rest of society, which is rational discourse. But that is not the fundamental problem on campuses today. That is an epiphenomenon of what I think is the more important problem, which is the incessant cultivation of a victim mentality. And while I applaud Kenyon's statement of principles, which seems admirable, as long as the victim ideology reigns dominant, the faculty can pass as many peons to freedom of expression, and it's not going to matter. Now, let me give you my vision of the reality of a university today. There has never been a more liberal, compassionate, and open-minded environment in human history. Traits that for centuries in Western civilization were the target of stigmatization and imprisonment, and that still can lead to stoning or death in other cultures, are actively celebrated on campuses. It's filled with pacific, well-meaning adults who are the least bigoted people in human history and who only wish the best for all of their students. Far from not caring about diversity, there are few faculty searches where the mandate from the dean is not explicit to interview and ideally hire as many females and underrepresented minorities as possible. In student admissions, so fervently does the administration and the faculty desire the presence of diversity on campus that they employ in selective colleges, very large racial preferences. We can argue about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it is not doing the alleged beneficiaries any good. The students are the most privileged individuals in human history at any college. They have unfettered access to the thing that Faust sold his soul for, knowledge. The Renaissance humanists would have killed for access to this college campus or any other. Every book in human history is available to you. You have scientific laboratories open without constraint. You have magnificent library collections. You have the ability, if you want, to learn languages, to learn history. This is the most privileged position that anyone has ever been in. And to test how valuable it is, there are millions of Chinese students at this very moment who are studying nearly 24 hours a day in order to enter this environment. Now, what I'm sketching out, what I see as the university's reality, is obviously not the dominant narrative today. The dominant narrative on college campuses is that to be a female or to be an underrepresented minority is to be the target of incessant and virtually lethal oppression. During the wave of protests that took college campuses in 2015 in the fall, a group of minority students occupied the provost office at Brown University and asked to be exempt from traditional academic requirements of showing up in class or doing their exams. Why? Because they said they were fighting to survive. They were fighting for their life at Brown. Now, I posit that that's a delusion. Nevertheless, it's a delusion that is generated by an unholy alliance between students and the growing student services diversity bureaucracy. At Berkeley campus, UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, the Division of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, which is funded at $20 million a year, the vice chancellor makes $250,000 a year, which is a pittance compared to UCLA's vice chancellor of equity, diversity, and inclusion, who makes $365,000 a year, which is much more than most faculty make. They have hung, this Berkeley division has hung banners throughout the campus emphasizing the university's paramount mission, which is to assign places in the highly competitive totem pole of victimhood. And one of a health services person says, I will be a brave and sympathetic ally. Well, we all know this language of allyhood. To need an ally means that divides the world up into the oppressed, the oppressors, and their allies. And if you're not in the oppressed or the ally category, you're one of the oppressors. One of the banners shows two underrepresented minority students who say, allow others than yourself to exist. Again, I would say that's a delusion. And the adults on campus, to the extent that they cultivate this mentality, are not doing those students any favors. Because they are not seeing that they have at their fingertips opportunities to learn and to plunge into real difference, which is studying something other than yourself, to plunge into the past. They will never have that opportunity again. But this view that universities are places of lethal threat is what leads ineluctably to the sense of entitlement to silence non-conforming speech, whether through administrative fiat or through violence. After the Milo riots in Berkeley on February 1st, a bunch of students wrote op-eds in the Berkeley student newspaper justifying the anti-FA tactics that rioted both on Berkeley campus and in the city of Berkeley. And they echoed the very language of these banners. Remember, allow others than yourselves to exist. One student said, I was fighting for the right to exist. Somebody else said, again, I was fighting for my life. As long as that sense is dominant, you are going to continue to get the demands to silence non-conforming speech because it is allegedly a threat to a student's identity. I would hope that for once, a college president, when faced with the demands saying, for any Brown student, I don't care if you are purple or green, to not realize that you are privileged to be there and that everybody is supporting your success, and to say that you're fighting to stay alive. For a president to kowtow before that and not say, get a grip. To be an adult means to see the difference between real and trivial problems. I would say that most microaggressions are trivial problems. There's Fordham University in New York came out with a list of microaggressions. One of them was being asked, well, what are you? Now, that's really dumb. It's a crude thing to say. But let's admit that in a world where we are told that ethnic identity and racial identity is the prime, most important component of somebody's worth or identity, the person is simply asking about an ethnic identity. So that is not something that I would say should stand in the way of a student's will to ace the chemistry exam. So we should absolutely argue for free speech, but it's going to be a losing battle as long as the victimology ideology reigns as powerfully as it does on college campuses. And I'll leave it at there. Thank you. There's a current example as well.
That, by the way, that was Professor Heather McDonald. And she is a gutsy person. She's very bright. Now, that doesn't mean she's right on everything, and you could agree or disagree, and I'd like to hear your points of view, especially from teachers, professors. We have a lot of them in this audience. In fact, last week, I never ask anyone what they do or their background. I just treat them all with equal respect, and it doesn't matter. You know, we don't want to get into treating someone who's famous better than someone who's not. And it's always been my policy that I don't care if a person's rich or poor, educated or not, whatever their race, ethnicity, religious belief, that's irrelevant to them getting help. I'm here to help people, not to discriminate against them or be biased. But it turns out at the end, on the last day, some people were telling what they did. We had like 7 professors, 6 medical doctors, in fact, a whole family of medical doctors. In fact, an oncologist professor from Sloan Kettering, a pain specialist, one of the top ones in America, their parents, who are also physicians. Why? What were they interested in? I asked him, I said, why are you here? What brings you here? And the answer was, we have seen things that we cannot explain, that we have never seen in our careers, and we don't understand it. And I said to them, but with the mindset that you've developed, you're not going to understand any answer. It doesn't fit. They're mismatched paradigms of understanding. In any case, we're going to ask you to call in now on our call-in number at 888-874-4888 and share your points of view about what you believe is happening to our educational system and our freedom of speech. Do you take issue with the fact that there's whole groups of people that we do not allow them to speak? We don't want to hear what they say. Whether they're right or wrong, we don't want to hear them. We simply want to lock them out of all dialogue, all forums. Is that right? Is that what we should do? Should we exclude anyone from any media at all because they hold a different position than we do on an issue? Or should we invite open debate so that let the public see the strength and weakness of any given position? And before you say yes or no to that, remember, Ralph Nader, through 3 presidential elections, and I supported him, was never allowed on that national stage. Had he been allowed to explain what was wrong and what we need to make it right, I believe we would have had an entirely different outcome today. Joel Stein was not allowed. Rocky Anderson was not allowed. Even Gary Johnson was not allowed. So we say we want the truth, and yet many of the truth bearers we exclude. Your thoughts. I'd like to hear them, please. That said, I believe, I'll know in a moment, if we have Dr. Steve on the line. Do we have Dr. Steve on the line? Let's see. Do we have Dr. Steve? No. Okay, well, hopefully he'll get through. In the interim, there's another one I thought you would find of interest. And this is how Dr. Steve's there. And after that, we're going to hear how an Asian looks at the concept of white privilege. So we'll hear from him in a moment. But Dr. Steve's on the line now. He's a board-certified physician, and he just spent a week at the retreat. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Gary.
Tell us what you experienced in observing and speaking with the people who were here last week, and you and I have not discussed this, so I'm going to hear for the first time what you have to say.
Right. Well, first off, I want to thank you for letting me come and observe and see some amazing things happening. Well, one thing, and I have a gentleman right next to me, his name's Bill, and when Bill came to the retreat, he came in a wheelchair and was unable to walk without any help. In fact, his doctors told him he had 3 months to live. And so Bill showed up last Sunday, so that was about 6 days ago.
A week ago.
So Bill showed up a week ago, and I believe it was on Saturday, he started walking on his own, unaided, with a cane, all by himself, and it was really amazing. It was so so wonderful to see Bill out of a wheelchair, out of a walker, just using his cane. And so this is a man who had 3 months left to live, and he's doing great.
And, let me speak to him.
Bill. Okay, Bill?
Yes, hi, Gary. How are you?
Bill, okay. You were given a death sentence by your physician. How long had you been in pain, and what were some of your specific medical conditions?
I have been suffering with diabetic nerve pain that is positively excruciating. I'm telling you, it's exactly like somebody took an ice pick and stabbed you in the foot and wiggled it, and it would stay for 24 hours at a time. Then it would go away for a day or two, then come back. I've been having headaches, unable to sleep properly, lower back pain. All of these things have totally disappeared. Now, I still have the neuropathy. It's going to take several months for that to disappear, but I can feel areas of my feet now and areas of my legs, which I could never, ever feel before. I had written it off. My doctors had written it off. They said, just get used to it till you die.
Were you recommended or prescribed opiates?
Yes. They said the only answer to my pain problem is certain opiates. I don't know the names of them. All I know is that the side effects are that you will become addicted to them. And I simply did not want to do that at all. Amputation was another step that I was looking, facing in the next month or so.
Ulcerations, the lower leg.
My toes were dark blue, and they're back to normal flesh color again.
So you came emaciated in a wheelchair. You were given a death sentence and unrelieving pain 24/7 with diabetic neuropathy, no sensation, no circulation in your lower extremities. They were blue and purplish. You were fatigued. You couldn't sleep. And you were beginning to suffer from dementia. Is that correct?
The dementia is something interesting. I've never recognized it, but other members of my family have pointed it out. I guess it's something you don't know that you have until it's so far gone.
So how do you feel 1 week later today?
I feel like a new man. I feel like I'm in my 30s. I'm alert. I'm sleeping well. I'm eating perfectly. I'm feeling fabulous, and it's all your fault. It is just wonderful.
Good for you. Now, what did you personally see in other individuals in their health improve?
Interesting question, because there are people here, one gentleman in particular last week, who was extremely overweight, and he's beginning to show some toning, but the most important thing, as he told me, is that he's able to get off his food allergies. He is accepting the proper diet. He is exercising like he's supposed to, and the alertness in his face, the alertness in his conversation is simply magical. And I've seen this with ladies, too, that have had problems, female problems, and those problems are disappearing for them as well. And it's all because they've decided to make the life change that you recommend and to eat properly and exercise properly.
Hey, Gary,
yes, Steve. Sure.
There's a few other people I'd like to talk about, too, that made some great changes while they were here. Yeah, there's one gentleman that came, and he had a feeding tube, And this man hadn't eaten by mouth in over 2 years. And he was getting so underweight that the doctors, that he was actually dying. And he's eating by mouth now, which is a huge advancement for this gentleman. And he looks great. He looks really super. So that's a real fantastic observation. And then we also have a person here who was on insulin. She had as high as a regular 190 blood sugar, and she's down to 90 now without any meds. So I really applaud her. She's really doing everything you ask her to do to be healthy, and she's doing it to the highest level. So I really applaud this woman. And
I spoke with her this morning. She dropped 100 points in her blood sugar into the high normal range this morning. The man who hasn't eaten, in, he told me 2.5 years any solid food, and he's lost over 30 pounds, and he came just like a skeleton. He's gained weight. He's able to eat and not have problems, solid food. But his wife had completely high blood pressure, even with medications. And this morning, her blood pressure, one of the nurses took her blood pressure, and it was completely normal for the first time in years.
Correct. And one other thing, the man that couldn't eat solid food, not just that he couldn't eat solid food, he had a feeding tube. He wasn't eating by mouth at all until he came here. A really amazing story with him. And on his wife with the high blood pressure, speaking of high blood pressure, there was another gentleman that came last week, and he was saying that he just could not get his blood pressure lowered without meds. He would go off the meds, and blood pressure would shoot up again. So he'd stay on the blood pressure medication. Then he'd try to get off the meds again, it would shoot up again. And after a few days when he was here, his blood pressure was down to normal. Amazing. So that was him. So I really seen some just amazing things. It's going to be a really exciting week this week. I really look forward to seeing some changes this week as well, Gary.
Okay. And by last quick question, because I want to get back to playing an audio. We have no calls. I was surprised. I thought we'd get people calling in on that issue. Is that we had a lot of physicians there last week, a lot of respected academic physicians.
Right.
I didn't speak to them, but you did. What was their response to all that they saw happening?
Well, it's something that that we all of us, all the physicians, that we don't see on a regular basis. We don't see at all at home in our home practices. And so it's just a lot of fun, all of us seeing things that that we don't ever see in our practices. And I know for sure some of those physicians, before they left, they said they wanted to implement some of the things that you do here into their practice. So, you know, I see that sort of paradigm change in the paradigm of how physicians treat their patients.
Well, I'm hopeful. They're ultra orthodox. They didn't understand until they actually saw things happen. But I'll get into all that on another show. Thank you very much, Steve, for calling in and sharing that
with us. Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Gary.
That's Dr. Steve, who he keeps coming back. He calls and says, "Gary, could I please come? I just want to see and study it and see if I can figure what the hell you're doing down there." He still hasn't figured it out, but he's seeing things that he had never seen in his practice nor his colleagues, their practice, but we're getting some phenomenal results, and you'll hear from these people in the future. I want to close out our program today with
okay, who argues for the protection, you know, of women in this way, okay, is not a true feminist.
I respectfully disagree with a lot of things you've said, but as a student, I think I'm going to raise some concerns about what you said about the university. I think in this debate, we've conflated two very different things, mollycoddling versus raising genuine concerns about structural gender and racial injustice in college and university campuses. I think what you call Generation Snowflake is a generation that recognizes diversity in the classroom and is more sensitive to the various kinds of injustices that students from all over the world come with. I'm from University of Oxford. I've been a participant in the Roads Must Fall movement. I think it's a convenient liberal argument to make for free speech by saying that, you know, just get over your problems. And what you said about spending time in the library and making education a personal enterprise, I think it's very easy to individualize these things from a position of privilege. But I think we should address greater concerns about very deep-rooted racial and gender injustices in our curriculum in the universities. Let's not trivialize very important concepts like safe spaces and trigger warnings, because it's easy to pick up, you know, small instances from schoolrooms and, you know, destroy the whole concept of having safe spaces in the universities. But they do address some very genuine concerns about bringing more equality, equity, and diversity to the classrooms.
Okay, so that was an important contribution because it actually reflects far more the popular position than anything or many of the things that Camille or you know, in a much lesser way, I have said. That is the kind of resonance.
To use the phrase diversity, okay, and believe that this is the way diversity will be achieved, okay, through this privileging of authority, of surveillance, okay, from above, okay. I just simply disagree. I believe true diversity is achieved through a genuine multiculturalism, which I have been arguing for 25 years, would be based on the study of world religions in the classroom. I believe that is the true diversity, is to authentically study the other culture, not through this enforced diversity and again, a Victorian kind of a discourse with all kinds of circumlocutions to avoid giving offense, right? So again, I simply disagree with what you've said. I'm sorry.
And the truth is that there is a split in this room, undoubtedly at this festival and in society. And what I hope over the next 2 days that we can do is to argue and not hide away in some spaces, which one can be glib about, but which I've actually read all of the literature on, which is why I'm so opposed to them, rather than I'm being glib. I know what the arguments are. I disagree with them. And people have got to argue for them rather than suggest that the person on the other side is being glib. So let's try and have that argument out and listen to each other and argue about it. One last person after that.
And I think one of the problems and why we disagree, you see, is that there is much too much focus on the present. In other words, when diversity becomes a banner for let's remedy this in the present, I don't think that's the purpose of education. Okay, I think education is about opening the great past, okay, and of global cultures generally. Okay, more knowledge, more hard knowledge. Okay? So this migration, okay, this transformation of the classroom situation and of the university setting into a praxis to cure present problems, that is wrong. The university should be about abstract and detached study of the past, okay, and of the global present. It should not be about remedying problems. That is a social welfare agency issue.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you all for listening. I'll look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.